Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bouncing Back, the Personal Resilience Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I am your host, Joanna. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Joanna, and welcome back to Bouncing Back, our personal resilience podcast. So for today's topic, we're going to be talking about binge eating and particularly how we can navigate it and the concept of body image as well. So to help me do this, I'm so pleased to say I'll be joined by Dr. Alyssa Knight. Alyssa is a clinical psychologist, researcher, and the founder of the Calming Suite in Adelaide here in South Australia. So it's designed to help people with mental health support and treatment, where she specializes in therapy, assessment, and counseling for adolescents and young female adults. Hi, Alyssa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so very much for having me here. I'm really honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, of course. I'm so excited to get into today. But before that, would you like to introduce yourself with a bit more about who you are and what it is you do?
Absolutely. As I think you lovely mentioned, I work predominantly as a clinical psychologist. I'm also a researcher, speak quite often for the media, and I focus on youth, predominantly with eating disorders, BPD, trauma, are my three kind of big presentations that I usually work with. I would, like to say I've spent probably the last 17 years of my life really passionately kind of searching the globe to kind of find ways to improve outpatient treatment for youth, particularly with complex mental health disorders. And sometimes that's been really challenging, trying to search for those types of ways, but it also has brought about some really remarkable experiences and opportunities to, meet with so many amazing people, particularly over in the US, the UK, and just to really learn and expand my own knowledge base is really something I think I'll always cherish.
Amazing. And along the lines of remarkable experiences, I know you've had a past working in roles such as a scientist, you've worked in psychiatry, psychology and nutrition. You've also worked as a primary school teacher, journalist and professional dancer. So please tell me more about that.
Absolutely. Yes, I think I've got a lot of hats my box. I've had a quite colourful career, lifespan. And I think, yes, I sort of really, really enjoy sort of growing in all different ways, as you can see. But I think, all of that experience has really come to make me what I am today. And I certainly find that working with such a diverse range of people, often or not, that really comes into handy when, meeting these people with different needs. So I find sometimes, I will draw from all those little different career aspects and pull in ways to really connect with people and build that rapport. Which is really, really nice. I think it's all come in really handy for me in my profession.
Beautiful. And can you tell me how you found yourself working in psychology now and how you came about the Calming Suite?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, as you pointed out, I was a primary school teacher. I also worked in journalism and research. And I think what I was finding is there were just so many, children and teenagers out there that were looking for help. But I probably essentially didn't really feel as a teacher I was equipped to deal with that complexity that I was seeing and that need. So at some point, I kind of just really sat there one day and thought, what could I actually do that could be better than what I'm already doing and really help these people? And I guess my passion for psychology was born, right there and then. And so I, began my journey at journalism and then went into psychology and really found myself just loving and breathing what psychology is. Went into research, as you mentioned, to start with. Just I love that kind of knowledge base and searching for answers and the why about, phenomena. But from that, it was really people that I love. Like I love people. So I felt that maybe a clinical psychologist where I get to work with people hands-on was more for me. And then over time, just thought, you know, I have two little babies of my own. So, you know, going on maternity leave, I just felt like maybe it's the time, maybe the time's right to delve into something of my own with my own practice and hence started the Calming Suite.
Awesome. Well, I feel like we're in really great hands for today's topic. So before we jump into everything else, we've got a little section we've called Have You Met Alyssa? So here we just get to know you a bit better with some more personal questions. So my first one for you is, do you have a favorite book or anything that you're reading at the moment?
Oh, favorite book. I would go to say professionally, or even personally, I think one of my favorite books of all is by Professor Van der Kolk's Body Keep the Score. I would say he's the godfather on the topic of trauma, and he just exudes in wealth of knowledge about it like nobody else. I think what I really love about this book is he really addresses, you know, the current direction that I think we're all progressing towards in the area of trauma, and really looking at how the body is in fact what gets stuck in that state of terror from the trauma. And so he really looks at new kind of modernized ways to help with that trauma, such as yoga, which I'm also as an instructor in. So I really loved that as well, that aspect of it. So yes, I think that was a really amazing book that I always recommend. And there's another one that I do love called Attached. And that's by Dr. Amir Levine and Rachel Heller. And I think this is a powerhouse in terms of really helping people understand attachment theory and, you know, why it's so important kind of within the context of making relationships and sustaining them, you know, in a way that really brings people fulfillment, love and happiness long term. So they're two I really like at the moment.
Amazing. And do you find that you get a lot of inspiration from what you read and translate that into your own work as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Look, I'm always about learning. I don't think you can ever stop learning. And for people like this who are just such, you know, amazing inspirational people with just that wealth of knowledge, like I said, I will always bring that into my practice. And particularly for my clients, I always embody, you know, that real mind-body connection. And we do a lot of somatic therapy, which is, as I said, yoga, you know, for trauma, yoga for eating disorders. And I find, you know, people that are willing to give it a go, the ones that put it alongside traditional forms of therapy, probably recover 50% faster, which is just incredible in itself. So yes, I'll always bring it in if I find that it's relevant and I can see how it would work for certain clients.
Beautiful. Well, my next one for you is about movies. Do you have a favorite movie or anything you're watching at the moment?
Yeah. Okay. So my ultimate favorite is Dirty Dancing. I love Dirty Dancing. Being a former dancer myself, that's going to be my love for the rest of my life, I think. But specifically, probably another one called I Am Maurice. And this is just such an inspirational recovery story about a teenage girl who was pretty much on the last thread of her life, you know, after unsuccessfully undergoing traditional kind of therapy for anorexia nervosa. And it just really, it's a beautiful story about how she, you know, finally came across yoga as her shining light that, you know, really guided her to a full recovery. So yeah, I would really recommend this movie as well to anybody, not just those that's going through an eating disorder. I think it really embodies strength, internal wisdom, and it's really that celebration of belief that, you know, you can really change even when things seem like they're really dark and impossible.
Yeah, I love asking this question because I feel like I get so many amazing recommendations and I often hear movies that I've never heard of before, like the one you've just suggested. So it makes me really curious. So thank you for suggesting that one.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, so my next one for you is about podcasts. Do you listen to any yourself?
Absolutely. I absolutely love podcasts. I think at the moment it's something I can just whack on when I'm driving home in the car. I just think, again, you're learning from so many wonderful people out there that have some just fascinating information. I really like Healthy-ish by Body and Soul. That's hosted by Felicity Harley. You know, I've been really privileged to be a guest on there a few times. But I think what I love about Felicity is she just dives into that diversity of topics. So it's, you know, really quite a lot of, and sometimes quite radical as well. So I really like the fact she pushes the boundaries with her topics. Differently Brained is another one I think is really quite good as well at the moment by hosts Jacinta Dietrich and Lachlan Rutherfield. And that kind of podcast is really, you know, specializing in neurodiverse guests with lived experience, which I think is really wonderful to be, you know, celebrating as well, and just gives an option for people that, you know, maybe not in their mainstream type podcasting can get some help. And I do also like the Unbreakable by the international powerhouse Gay Glazer. That's what I really enjoy listening to as well.
Perfect. Seems like you are quite the connoisseur in podcasts here. Got some great recommendations for us. I have heard of Body and Soul. That one's come up quite a lot for me when I look for like health-based sort of inspirational podcasts. So I'll have to give that one a go.
Perfect. Good stuff.
Awesome. So my last one for you is, do you have a famous role model or perhaps just anyone in your life that you look up to?
Yeah, I think for me, probably the person that's been the most inspirational of all, particularly for my journey, is Carolyn Costin from the US. She would have to be, in my opinion, you know, the leading expert in the field of eating disorders worldwide. You know, she began her journey in the 1980s after successfully recovering from anorexia herself. And then she kind of went on to be really, at the time, very radical, pushing the like status quo and developed this beautiful residential eating disorder program in the California mountain city called Montenegro. And she was like the first to deviate from traditional eating disorder therapeutic approaches and really revolutionize a model of care that she believed her clients were truly in need of. So I really like built from her and kind of learned quite a lot from her and just how to be not afraid to really, you know, progress and really evolve.
Awesome. I feel like hearing from people or just even looking up to people who have lived experience in the field of whatever you're working in is so inspirational, and seeing how their journey has transpired is just really awesome.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Awesome. So I think we're ready to jump right into our interview questions now. So my first one for you is, what does resilience mean to you in your own definition?
Yeah, I think resilience is kind of almost equally intriguing as it is to define. You know, just asking the question, isn't it? Like, you know, why is it that one person can embrace the tough times that come out shining while another person in the same situation crumbles? It's really quite fascinating human phenomena. You know, I think a lot of what I've learned in myself and also working with, you know, many people now with all different variants of mental health issues is that inner resilience is definitely an important resource to harness. And I think it's really the basis of good mental health. You know, I think learning about how to become more resilient is important if we look at the difference it has and the impact it has on our physical mental health. And, you know, by definition, you know, in the context of humanity, it's really that ability to kind of remain flexible in our thoughts, feelings, behaviors, you know, when faced with life stresses and challenges and extended periods of pressure, and really coming out of it, you know, emerging stronger, wiser, and more empowered. And people that are typically more adaptable, this is something I had to learn, you know, probably earlier on, is to have that level of flexibility to be able to open up to new challenges and experiences and really be able to adopt that healthy perspective, you know, when you're in face of a setback and see it more as an opportunity for learning.
For sure. And I feel like it's so interesting you brought up that thing of how some people rise above the occasion and some people crumble. And that's where resilience is so subjective as well. Everyone's got their own definition of what it is. And resilience means something different to everyone. And they've got their own skills, their own little toolkit of things to use to show resilience. So I feel like it's such a diverse and interesting topic as well.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that anymore.
Awesome. Well, my next one for you is just diving straight into binge eating. Before we get into those, though, I'd actually love to ask you what binge eating is.
Yes, I mean, a binge eating clinically is where, you know, somebody is, you know, using really kind of unhealthy ways of, you know, eating a large proportion of food in a short space of time. Often or not, it's where, you know, it's not just your, you know, feeling a little bit bloated from eating probably what would be more than the average meal. It is huge, like consuming huge amounts of food would be quite unnecessarily normal to the average person. So often or not, it's sort of seen as like feeling like they can't physically tolerate that amount of food as well, and then feeling like they've got to get rid of it in most cases. Some people can tolerate it, other people always delve into things like purging to get rid of that huge amount of food they've just taken in.
Yeah. And is binge eating something you develop over a longer period of time, or is that something that people just start doing immediately?
Oh, look, I think it's always embedded in, you know, a process. It's not really something that you just wake up one day and start doing. There's always a history behind the binge eating, but it can certainly pop up out of nowhere. And usually it's a response to something that's been triggered. It's a coping mechanism. And so then they'll just find themselves slowly kind of embedded in this, what we call, it's an eating disorder. So they'll just find themselves within it. And it's very, very hard to get out of it once you're in it. So it's sort of something that can sneak up on you, but usually is a process.
Yeah. And along the line of triggers, do you know what some of the most common emotional triggers are that might lead to binge eating?
Absolutely. You know, from what I know and hear a lot of the time, it's usually when they're like not really feeling good about themselves, or they don't feel good enough, or they might feel like a failure or unworthy or defective in some way. I hear a lot of not accepted. They feel like they're not accepted, or they're being negatively judged by others. Or it could be things like, you know, from excessive receiving criticism, negative feedback. You know, being told by a loved one or a parent they're lazy or they're stupid or unmotivated, or they might be a lost cause, really negative, harsh kind of comments. It could be things like seeing other people on social media, you know, who have just what looks to them like, you know, everything, like aesthetically beautiful or the perfect body shape, or they look like they've got the perfect family or career. Or they may also be having thoughts or flashbacks of those past traumas, and all of those, you know, are really embodied in quite emotionally being triggered.
Yeah. And how do we go about differentiating from binge eating and then the occasional overeating?
Yes. So, I mean, as I was sort of briefly mentioning there, you've kind of got your just overeating where you might sort of feel like you've just eaten a little bit more than normal, and that might give you that kind of feeling that, you know, you've just had a little bit too much, whereas binge eating is, by definition, you've eaten an extraordinarily amount. So we're talking, you know, it could be a whole mud cake. It could be a whole pot of pasta as opposed to a dish. It could be you're still going. You might go back for ice cream, and it just keeps on going to the point where you are physically unable to take any more in. But the mind almost is somewhat dissociated in that moment, so you can just keep on packing it in. So there's a difference between just overeating and binge eating. Binge eating is like an excessive amount.
Yeah. And how do we go about addressing some of those emotional triggers that we talked about before? And, you know, how can we address those underlying emotional triggers to help overcome binge eating?
Yeah, I think this question actually kind of solidifies possibly the greatest necessity to really understanding eating disorders in general. I think we're really, you know, moving now towards a much greater appreciation that eating disorders, you know, really are a complex, multidimensional and dynamic illness. So they're not simply about food and weight. You know, you have to really take a look at the deeper layers, you know, underneath that, really to really be able to overcome it. And, you know, definitely, you know, those deep layers are often ingrained in issues with emotional dysregulation that have usually come about from, you know, early childhood experiences where a person's emotional needs kind of were not met by authoritative figures. And often, you know, they are parents or older siblings, teachers. Sometimes it can be sports coaches. A lot of attachment being criticized, as I've mentioned before. And consequently, what we kind of see is that emotional part of the brain is overdeveloped, and the frontal lobes, the part of the brain responsible for rational decision-making and planning, like particularly within that binging moment, is not, it's kind of underdeveloped. So what tends to happen in those children is to become really emotionally dysregulated quite fast. They don't have the tools to cope, calm themselves down and regulate. Their soothe system, so to speak, is almost switched off. So, you know, as a consequence, when they grow into adults, they just simply, you know, really still operate emotionally in the same way, and they don't have those tools to regulate their emotions. So when they're overwhelmed and they're feeling anxiety, they kind of channel it into something else. And sometimes that is harmful ways of coping, like self-harming, cutting. but others will use self-harming methods like the binge eating. So, you know, it really is paramount that you have someone with clinical binge eating behaviors that you really have to help them learn ways to switch back on their soothe system in the brain and emotionally regulate.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like understanding all these layers behind an eating disorder is so important, because I know a lot of times when you talk to someone who may not have a good understanding of eating disorders like binge eating, they'll be like, oh, just stop eating so much. Oh, just eat more. You know, like if it was that simple, people would do that. So I feel like understanding these emotional triggers is so crucial.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that anymore.
Yeah, awesome. Well, my next question for you is understanding, like, how can we understand some more effective strategies for managing and preventing binge eating episodes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think where you just sort of pointed out there is a really great place to start, you know, in terms of appreciating that, you know, binge eating episodes, you know, are really triggered by either a direct stressful life experience, and it could be like an argument with a partner, or perhaps a more subtle trigger like seeing a photo of oneself, and that really erupts that deeper negative core belief, and that in turn, you know, leads to that emotional overwhelm like we've just been speaking about. And I think we need to address all of that if we're really able to help somebody manage and prevent binge eating episodes. What is definitely not helpful, and that's rather contrary to what most people think, is to really assume that, you know, if I simply take all the food out of my pantries, like remove all the chocolate, the pasta, the noodles, the cakes, the ice cream, that's just going to fix it. And, you know, if it's not there, I won't eat it. And I won't be able to binge. But that's never the solution. You know, that's always just putting a temporary band-aid on the problem. And to be honest, you know, all it takes usually is a phone call to Uber Eats, and that person has easily fulfilled the void. You know, so for my clients, what we go through is a process of firstly, identifying what their own personal triggers are. So, for example, is it that, you know, you were bullied when they were 14 about their body shape and they're still being emotionally impacted by that every time they're reminded of it? Is it that when they were little, they were always told by mum that food wastage is a bad thing and they can't leave the table until all their food has been eaten? And, you know, is it that they're working in a toxic workplace, for example, and they've been micromanaging boss who, you know, constantly puts them down? And what's happened is they've associated that food equals what helps make you feel better about yourself and really relieve those bad emotions. So it's just a maladaptive coping mechanism. And then what we do is we work on those things step by step and help the person learn ways to overcome the trauma of that, so that those experiences no longer hold emotional power over them. So we really also help the person understand that binge eating, you know, is not the answer to relieving that emotional distress. And truly, you know, after engaging in binge eating episodes, what tends to happen is they're whacked by, you know, a surge of more emotional distress. And usually it's in the way of shame and guilt. So, you know, what we try to do is provide the person with a host of effective strategies and techniques that really offer a person that relief from the emotional pain and distress. I like to use things like emotional freedom techniques or tapping, you know, other simple distraction techniques. I use a lot from dialectical behavior therapy or DBT. And then depending on the level of severity in which the person presents with binge eating, if it's really severe, I bring into action what's called exposure relapse prevention. And it's just, in short term, it's just a matter of small hierarchy, step ladder, tiny goals in place. And we go through that.
Yeah. And I know you just touched on, you know, past triggers from people's past. Like you mentioned, oh, if you've grown up and your mum's always told you to finish all the food on your plate. Do you think those triggers are intentional, or people find things from their past and they hold on to those things?
Probably 50-50. I think some parents are aware of the messages they're sending, but others are not. You know, that's probably intergenerational. They've probably heard the same messages from their parents. What I do know is, unfortunately, those messages and comments that are said, particularly in early childhood, stick, and they're internalized, and they almost become the inner critic, the own voice of that person when they're an adult. You know, and sort of in that moment when they're sitting in front of a plate of food, almost hearing that same voice, you know, saying whatever it is in that moment, like, you know what, you shouldn't eat that. that's what, or eat all of what's on your food. You're wasting food here. What a waste of money. All those children, you know, in those third world countries aren't getting any food. How dare you leave that food right now? So it just plays like almost like a megaphone in their mind.
Yeah. And based on that, do you think it's important to, you know, develop and increase the amount of education that not only like young people have access to, but also adults and parents?
Absolutely. As I said, I don't think any parent out there on the planet would intentionally try to harm their child. Nobody would be in that, you know, category. But I think what it is sometimes we're not equipped more so to understand the emotional impact we're having and the emotional needs that children have. So while we do a good job in other sort of categories, like we might give them everything they need for school and sport and clothing and, you know, read them books every night, sometimes we don't realize, you know, what toll we have with just purely our own behaviors. You know, walking around the house talking about, oh God, my bottom looks so big today, or, oh, I've got to go on another diet, or I've got to have that juice today because, oh, I'm getting a little bit big, aren't I? You know, we don't realize that children are taking that in, they're soaking all of that up. And that just hits them in the face with this idea that, oh, okay, that I have to do that too to be a good person. Or, you know, that's what it's kind of sending. So I think if we had a level of sort of education out there for parents, just to make them aware, look, we know that you go through a hard time too, but when you're around your child, you know, the words, the choice of words that you use and the messages you send are really, really important to their emotional health.
Yeah, 100%. And further along the lines of like emotional eating, are there any ways to identify the difference between, you know, genuine hunger and when we actually need to eat versus emotional eating and eating because of what we're feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if we're really thinking about, we're thinking about hunger over emotion is a big thing I sort of talk to my clients about. And it's really identifying what's a genuine hunger cue versus emotional eating. For my clients, what I do is I help them recognize or differentiate between 7 types of hunger. And that sounds like a lot,
wow.
I know.
Yeah.
Actually, there's 7 types. So number one is what I call stomach hunger. And that's sort of, you know, the physical hunger when you feel your body genuinely needs nourishment. It's that, you know, pang in your tummy that comes along. It's almost like butterflies there. That's when you really do need food, okay? Then there's mind hunger. This is like more emotional or psychological hunger. It's kind of driven by things like stress, anxiety, trauma, boredom. That's kind of what's going to lead you more to that emotional eating. We have eye hunger, believe it or not, which is simply the desire for food stimulated by seeing delicious looking food like a cake sitting on the kitchen table your mum's just baked. Again, could kind of lead you more into that emotional eating. We have nose hunger, which is cravings triggered by the aroma of food. And I know for me, this hits me all the time when it's a hot summer's night and I'm driving past McDonald's or KFC on the way. You know that waft you get, the smell that kind of, oh my gosh, she just hits you in the face. And, you know, for a lot of people, you just can't resist and end up driving in the drive-thru because of that. I think they do that deliberately, by the way. I don't know if that's ever come out. It's deliberate because it's like very hard to dismiss. You've got mouth hunger, and that's kind of when you're sitting at your desk or you're in front of the TV and, you know, you almost feel your mouth start to salivate at the desire for a particular taste, like an orange texture, maybe like you feel like an orange or, you know, a crunchy bar of some kind. We have heart hunger. This is a newer one I've come across, which is kind of where you know, you feel lost or you feel lonely and you're just longing for some kind of emotional connection or comfort from a person, but you really don't have that. So you turn to food for that fulfillment. And very last, there is nutrient hunger. And this is where, you know, you're perhaps depleted nutritionally, like really low iron levels or vitamin B, and you just crave those foods for high amounts of those nutrients that generally your body is kind of telling you that you need. And that's kind of another one where you kind of, that's when you do need to eat. And I think from having an awareness of all those 7 types of hunger cues, it's really good then to pay attention to your bodily sensations that indicate hunger. You know, again, grumbling stomach, low energy levels, they're the kind of hunger cues that, you know, where you're not best to deny yourself or be restrictive. On the other hand, if it's more the appetite or the emotion, desire to eat the food, you know, influenced by those emotions or external factors, they're the time when really I know that that piece of cake looks amazing, but it's more in those moments where, okay, I don't really need this right now, I'm just desiring it. If you really want it, that's okay. But, you know, it's really asking yourself in that moment, do I need it or do I just want it, and making that decision.
Yeah, for sure. And I totally agree about the drive-through thing. Like, I feel like they're done so on purpose and they're just there. Like, conveniently, the drive-through is just so easy to just drive in and just grab, like, food on the way. I'm pretty sure it's a strategic move by McDonald's and KFC, so 100%. But, yeah, I find – yeah, and I often find myself asking myself that question as well, like, do I actually need to eat this, or does it just look really good or smell really good, or just like even the sensation of eating it, does that entice me as well? And often it's really hard to say no. It's really hard to be like, no, I don't need that. It's often I'll have it now and then tomorrow will be a better day.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people do that. It's okay to not deny it. If you really would like that piece of cake, that's okay. It's when it kind of falls into, you know, a pattern of, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a day, and you kind of find yourself, you know, entrenched in this kind of negative kind of pattern of eating where all of a sudden you're always giving into your emotions. I think that's where we kind of define it between it's okay every now and then versus it's happening like 3, 4, 5 times a day.
Yeah. And when you find yourself in that situation, how can people go about reaching out for help? Because I know that can be really hard. And people often don't want to reach out for help because they're embarrassed or they're scared or they just don't want anyone to know.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's so much stigma around eating disorders in general. Out of every single presentation in mental health illness, I think they're the least to come forward because of that stereotype stigma. And shame that comes about it, which I just wish was not there, because everybody deserves the right to treatment and help if they're really going through something that they would like help with and they don't feel they can manage on their own. And it can be so empowering to just be with somebody to guide them through it, because, you know, we all at some point get really trapped in this cycle where things aren't going quite right in your life. You might have a lot of trauma there. There might be a lot of emotion dysregulation, and food becomes that weapon for you, that way of coping. And sometimes it just gets out of control. So, you know, if people are out there that, you know, are really battling with that, I would love to say to all of those people, please, you know, feel like you can come forward. Nobody is going to be there to judge you. Everybody's going to be there with open arms to help you through it. And you absolutely deserve it if you want and need it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And do you have any sort of resources you could recommend? Like, accessing things online has made, you know, overcoming these things and finding support so easy. So do you have any tools you might suggest?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always, you know, nowadays, isn't it? We're saturated hyper technology. So I think in this current day and age, it's quite easy to access a lot of information, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and I think you can dive into, you know, the things we've already talked about. You can dive into podcasts. We can dive into, you know, helping sort of groups online. There are some social peer groups online that can help with this. There's lots and lots of information on good kind of like eating disorder websites. Inside Out is one that offers some really great information about this. Obviously, the Butterfly Foundation also has some wonderful information. Dove is also really big in this field at the moment as well. You know, and if, even if you just start with a basic, if that sounds a little bit too overwhelming to you, simply just jumping on Google, you know, if you need to, and, you know, typing in binge eating will really lead you to a lot of websites that can give you that information, maybe on where to start. If you're looking to engage with a psychologist, it's just a simple process for you. All you need to do is go to your local GP, have a discussion with your GP. Might be a great place to start, just to say, look, these are my concerns. I'm wondering if you, what's your thoughts on this? And could you recommend, you know, a psychologist to me, or, you know, a counselor or a social worker that might be able to help me with that? And that could be, you know, maybe your first step.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like having access to technology has made things so much easier. And Google is such a underrated resource, I feel, sometimes, because as simple as searching up binge eating can lead you down a rabbit hole, and you can come out half an hour later being so like educated about a topic that you might not know a lot about.
Oh, yes. I think there's two sides to it, isn't there? There's like the wonderful side where you've just got, you know, access to an endless amount, copious amount of information. But then there's also that side that, you know, you can end up being your own Google doctor and kind of, you know, diagnosing yourself and, you know, making yourself aware that I have all these illnesses just by purely looking at, you know, a set of symptoms. So yep. I think, you know, it's really, maybe it's a great place to start where you jump on and you're like, okay, I'm worried about this. You get some basic information on it, but then really go to your GP as that first step and say, look, I have been on Google. I've noticed these things. I'm wondering what your opinion is and whether I need to go to a specialist and kind of get some more, you know, tailored like help with this problem.
Yeah, I feel like that's the perfect disclaimer, because there's been so many times, and I feel like a lot of people can relate, but you have this one little symptom, you Google it and suddenly you're about to die or something like that because you try to self-diagnose yourself.
Correct. And I think I've had myself included.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's very important to say that. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'd love to transition into talking about body image as well. So I feel like it's quite related to what we've been talking about, but how can binge eating affect someone's body image?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we in this day and age, as I said, we are really like looking at a place where body image in itself is something that where really no one's going to be escaping. You know, I think we've all been sort of at some point attacked by the cultural stigma that we really have in westernized society, which portrays, you know, all of us having either the thin ideal for women or the athletic kind of body shape for men. And sometimes it's really hard to kind of remove yourself from that. And then when we have social media now that's literally 24/7 splashed in your face, with digital retouching on one side and trying to work out on the other side what's real and what's not, it's hard not to make a comparative to yourself. You know, it's hard to escape that feeling that maybe I'm not good enough. I'm not living up to these ideals. I won't be accepted if I look the way I do, if I'm not a size 8 or, you know, if my legs are a little bit too long or short or whatever it could be. And it's really in that moment sort of sometimes leading people down a path where they get trapped in feeling like they've got to do better and meet those standards. But it's sort of really pulling yourself back from that and sort of trying to remove yourself from those ideals.
Yeah. So how can mindful eating come into play to help us build a more positive body image?
Yeah, absolutely. I think mindful eating really stems from a broader philosophy of mindfulness, of course. You know, which is the intentional focus on one's thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations in the present moment. Mindfulness targets becoming more aware of rather than reacting to one's situation and choices. And I think in contrast to binge eating, which is often experienced almost in the complete opposite way to being present, because as I think I mentioned earlier, most people are usually quite dissociated or detached in binge eating episodes. And this kind of leads into eating an extraordinary, you know, amount of food without even kind of cognitively being aware. So, you know, mindful eating is really about being, you know, exceptionally present when eating and to the level that you're really tuning in to all of your physical and emotion senses as you experience and enjoy the food and the choices that you make.
Yeah. Personally, I've tried mindful eating before, but I find it can be so difficult because you're sitting there trying to focus on what you're doing. And then 2 seconds later, your mind's off in another place and you come back 10 minutes later, you finished all your food and you're like, oh, I've just completely undermined this entire process. So what's your advice for people starting off with this technique?
Yeah, I know. It is harder said than done. I totally realize that. And to be fair, a lot of techniques are like that. It sounds good in theory. And then when you jump into it, particularly on your first or second go, sometimes you can feel quite defeated because you realize I haven't been able to manage it in that moment. It hasn't gone to plan.
Yeah.
I would say to people, try to give it a few goes. Before you make your mind up about it. But at the same time, if it doesn't work out for you, don't sort of whack yourself with that guilt, because it's okay if it doesn't work out the first time. You know, it's more about just committing to each incrementally having a time over, like, you know, process of 8, 9, 10 times of doing it. And then eventually what tends to happen is, without even being consciously aware, the brain and the body just catches on. So you just find yourself all of a sudden kind of being more mindful in the moment as you eat, as opposed to just channeling all that food down without any thought. So I just say to people, just really not so commit to it, like, you know, you have to do it in a certain way and I haven't done it the right way, so now I'm a bad person, as opposed to just giving it a go, and whatever works for you is totally okay.
Yeah, perfect. Couldn't have said it any better myself. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. Now, we've talked about some of the internal pressures, you know, like the emotional triggers from our past along those lines. But what about external pressures? I know that, you know, in popular culture, the fashion industry, social media have contributed so much to, you know, pressures to attain this ideal body image. So how can, you know, society help cultivate, you know, a safer space where people don't feel pressured to, you know, try and achieve these unrealistic standards?
Oh, fantastic question. I really love that, because I think the cultural stigma, you know, around weight gain and larger body size and that real idealization of, you know, fitness in Western countries like Australia is just so pervasive. Nobody escapes it. You know, even elite athletes, you know, don't always love their strong and talented bodies, you know, due to the pressures and messages that our culture gives us. So that's really worth emphasizing right there. But I think we need to really fight back at society values that emphasizing the importance of, you know, appearance, by just simply stepping away from it, you know, and not giving it power. You know, the more that we give in to really accepting those ideals, the more that they become ingrained and internalized within our society. And, you know, the one thing I love about Gen Z is their capacity to embrace equality and diversity and so many other things like gender, race, and sexuality. And more than any other generation, they appear to be the real front runners for change and striving towards a more progressive and inclusive world. So what we need is for them to take that wonderful quality and extend that now to body image, to really lead the way in rejecting those body ideal stigmas and creating a world that offers body inclusivity and health at every size.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like, you know, social media and, you know, popular culture have really focused on this idea of perfection. And to me, I've always said that the attainment of perfection is the attainment of something that doesn't really exist. So I feel like trying to break that down is so important, because I feel like at the end of the day, you're never going to be perfect in someone else's eyes. You know, models are always too skinny. Athletes are always too strong. We're always too something or too little of something else. So it's so important not to base yourself off a perfect standard that society has set.
Without a doubt. I don't think you could have said that any more perfect.
Thank you for that. Awesome. I'd love to talk about, for listeners struggling with body image concerns and how to embrace themselves and love themselves, considering all the stigma that exists, all these pressures that exist, how can they go about just practicing self-love?
Oh, amazing. I think, you know, we've talked about it today, but I think it's really liberating when you can, you know, really step away from putting your appearance into a category of ideal and just waking up each day and embracing how remarkable your body actually is for the things it does for you. Like, just thinking about our bodies, like, we can birth babies, we can recover from sporting injuries, they allow you to run, they allow you to ski, they allow you to swim and do yoga. And you know what? If you can't love your body right now, that's okay. That's actually okay. But maybe try to at least respect it for all that it does for you, and just be kind to yourself in that regard. You know, maybe you can't love the way your body looks right now. Maybe you don't like your legs or your arms or your stomach. But you know what? You can love that it just allowed you to go for a 6K walk through the hills and smell that gorgeous aroma of the trees and the air and feel the sun on the back of your wind and your hair. You know, and nobody else out there in this whole universe has your human imprint. And that's what makes the idea of beauty standard, or even the word pretty, so falsified. Because how do you even measure beauty when the word itself cannot go past the exterior layers of a human? So what I would really love everybody to do, and I say to my clients, is can you wake up each day and just embrace that kind of self-compassion? What you will find, and it's going to really start to be able to detach from all the procrastinating negative thoughts and the fear of being judged or rejected or evaluated by others purely for your outer aesthetics. And when you can really do that, oh gosh, it becomes liberating.
Beautiful. I feel like we keep having these moments of you couldn't have said it any better. So that was absolutely awesome. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Perfect. So I'd love to get into our practices and habit debrief section. So here we're just going to focus on a specific strategy that you recommend to help deal with binge eating disorders.
Certainly, certainly. I think, you know, start off by saying there isn't really one practice. Overcoming something as complex and severe as clinical binge eating really takes a wide range of intervention strategies and techniques. I think I spoke a little bit about it earlier in terms of just an overview of what I do. But in my opinion, the most important step of all is to start with exploring the cause or where did this binge eating originate from? Then I look at what is perpetuating it or what's keeping it alive per se. You know, at all the factors around the whole essence of the binge eating, as opposed to simply focusing on the binge eating behavior itself. You know, and if you just try and target that, it's never going to seize the binge eating. Binge eating 9 out of 10 times is born from trauma. And most often in early childhood where our emotional needs were not met, as we talked about earlier. And sometimes it can be a really traumatic experience later in life that kind of precipitates a person to feel completely overwhelmed with emotion and lead them to that binge eating as a maladaptive coping mechanism. However, mostly it's often that consequence of those negative internalized messages, as we've talked about, that they took in as an early child. And it really gives them those really vacuum of dark clouds circulating, those deep core beliefs. I'm just not good enough. I'm not worthy. I'm invisible. And those deep core beliefs are often played on a megaphone in their mind by that inner critic voice. They become very unbearable. And some people just channel that desperate plight into thinking that they just need some kind of distraction just to shut it all off. And that tends to lead them to the binge eating as a punishment in the moment. Feels good, but then afterwards they're whacked with those other guilt emotions as I've talked about. So in some sense, it's almost like a dissociated trance. But, you know, with that, I really feel after that, I think we got to look at the fact that food is not the ultimate answer to shutting off those emotions. And, you know, if you ask a person who's battling the darkest layers of depression and sometimes even suicidality, you know, it helps in a split moment, but they'll tell you 10 out of 10 times that that's just, they'll just do anything they can to shut it off. So I think with clinical binge eating, what we want to do is really target those deep core beliefs. And that's kind of where I start. And I often use something called schema therapy, which I think is just a wonderful therapy for these like deep core beliefs and really connecting the adult self who's binge eating to their child self where it might have started. I use what's called imagery rescripting and limited reparenting. And that's really around developing that understanding around the origins of their binge eating problem and then connecting into their current issue and really focusing on that and not assigning blame and developing self-compassion. And just to give you a little bit of example of how that can actually play out and what this actually means, a few months ago I had a client who made a really powerful connection with her experience growing up in her family and how she developed her binge eating. You know, she mentioned that her binge foods were hot chips and gravy. You know, and like when she had a binge episode, she would literally go and order enough hot chips and gravy to feed a party of 12, you know. And now growing up, she came from a very strict family. Her parents would not let her do anything by herself and they ate only healthy foods the majority of the time. But most importantly, they would always emphasize her older sister and how reliable or responsible she was because she was like the golden child. You know, and her sister would always be praised and hugged a lot and smiled at and given what looked like everything to her. And her sister just seemed so special to her parents. And this always made her feel like she was second best, not good enough. Something was wrong with her. And she desperately had no attention or emotional love, what it felt like to her. Now, when she was 14 years old, her mother wouldn't, you know, would let her go once a week to the local fish and chip shop to order hot chips for the family. And in this moment, you know, she had never felt so important to her family. Like she was the chosen one, not her sister. She felt happy and warm and fuzzy inside and independent. And it was like a blissful utopia for her each week when she got to go and get hot chips. So in therapy, during one of those schema therapy imagery re-scripts, she finally made the connection that as an adult, it was never even about the hot chips as to why she found herself always indulging in those hot chips in her binges. It was any time as an adult she was triggered by a friend, a work boss, a boyfriend, anyone who made her feel those same negative emotions of not being good enough, invalidated, unworthy, unimportant, second best, or not accepted, she turned to hot chips because that was what worked for her when she was feeling 14 years old. So she'd unconsciously associated hot chips with the ultimate feeling of acceptance, love, praise, worthiness from her parents and happiness and safety that she felt at 14 years old. So it was a really powerful connection she made. And it was indeed a really turning point for her in therapy that gave her a chance at recovery. We really had to tune into that memory and the associated feelings around it. And then through a limited reparenting, really teach her new healthier ways to make her feel emotionally safe, loved, accepted, worthy, that were not hot chips. Something I use is probably emotional freedom techniques or tapping.
Yeah, and this kind of technique and process, is this something someone can try and observe within themselves without going to a professional, or do you recommend that they do this process with a professional?
Yeah, I would love to say it's one of those techniques that they could do on their own, but this one's probably best to do with a psychologist. This one's better because it evokes sometimes that trauma response and you really want to feel safe in that moment. You want to leave that clinic feeling much more liberated and able to handle the binge eating. Whereas I think if you're doing it on your own, there's always a risk that when you're diving back into early childhood experiences, you might be triggered in some way. So I think probably best to save it for clinical, whereas the emotion freedom techniques, the tapping, that is something that, you know, if you do learn it, it is something you can practice on your own.
Okay, yeah, because I feel like I do understand that, because sometimes people, when they want to try do things for themselves, they don't really know where to start. And, you know, diving back into the past can be triggering, and then they might find themselves in a situation where they don't know how to handle what they've uncovered. So I feel like that's where having a professional can be good. But what about people who might be scared to reach out for professional help because it feels a bit too much?
Yeah. Again, look, I think if you are someone that's, you know, really frightened of reaching out, or you've had a bad experience maybe with a psychologist before, and maybe that's something that's sort of stopping you reaching forward. Again, it's probably a good place to start. Maybe have a chat to a friend, have a chat to a mum or somebody that you really trust, right? And just speak to them about it. Just say, look, I'm actually going through something. I don't know what my barrier is. Like, I know I need help, but I don't know what the barrier is. And maybe just see if that person that you do trust and you feel safe with can really unpack it for you there, you know? And then what I would recommend if you are frightened is to maybe really then, you know, talk to your GP and just say those fears. You know I need help, but I've really got some fears, and my fears are A, B, C, D, you know? And if I were to get help, I would need somebody that I'd find really relatable, that would be really compassionate and safe and gentle with me. Do you know anybody like that? You know, and maybe that's a great place to start.
Yeah, awesome. And, you know, linking this back to, you know, the overarching topic for today, which is resilience, how does the act of reaching out for help build someone's resilience in life?
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you're feeling that you're not quite able to cope with something on your own, or you're feeling like everything's getting a little bit too much in your life, you know, it's to be resilient in that moment is really about sort of saying to yourself, you know what, like this is hard. You know, I'm not quite sure how to ride this wave, but why not just give it a go? Let's just see what happens on the other side. What could be worse than the way I am right now? And if I take one brave foot forward, what can be on the other side? And just saying to yourself that it can't be any worse than I'm finally in. And just taking a deep breath and going forward with that. And that in its essence is resilience, just by being able to make that first step. I think that's wonderful. We don't need to worry about what's going to go on long term. Let's save the future for later, but just take one step forward. And that's how I think we can build on that level of resilience.
Yeah, perfect. I feel like having that courage and confidence, even just to take a leap outside of your comfort zone, is resilience in itself. And it's the first step forward into building resilience, something that you can fall back on if you were to find yourself in a place of adversity in the future as well.
Oh, wonderful. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And that also brings us to the end of today's episode. But yeah, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so very much for having me here. It has been an absolute pleasure.
It's been so fun chatting to you. And for those of us who want to find out a bit more about you, where can we go?
Yeah, you can either visit my home website, which is at thecalmingsuite.com.au. I'm also on Instagram. I'm also on my Facebook. Feel welcome to pop onto there and see what I'm doing.
Perfect. Well, we also have Alyssa's details down in the description below. But to everyone watching, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Bouncing Back, the Personal Resilience Science Insights podcast produced by the Life Management Science Labs. Listen to episodes from LMSL's 10 Life Management Perspectives on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or other podcasting apps on your smartphone. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it and us grow to bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website, pr.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Joanna. Thanks for tuning in.